Welcome to Echo Tones. I'm Joy LaClaire. We're glad that you can join us for a lively conversation with author, journalist, podcaster, and radio personality, Russell Rowland. You may know him from his radio program, 56 Counties, that broadcasts on Yellowstone Public Radio. That's also the title of one of his nonfiction books. His novels include In Open Spaces, The Watershed Years, Arbuckle, and Cold Country. His latest book is a memoir, Be a Man, Raised in the Shadow of Cowboys. In it, he reflects on what it means to grow up in the West from boyhood to manhood, how he came to be a writer, and why he chose to return to his roots here in Montana after so many years away. We spoke with him in our Beyond the Deep End studio on June 6, 2025. Russell, thank you for joining us on Echo Tones today. We very much appreciate it. In honor of the late, great Brian Kahn, let's start with talking about where you grew up and what did your folks do?
Well, that's a good question, and it sort of relates to the book because my mother grew up on a ranch in southeastern Montana. So she was a ranch girl, but kind of a reluctant one. My dad grew up in a very poor family in Casper, Wyoming. And interestingly enough, her mom lost her husband when my mom was two. And so she ended up marrying this ranching family, which was fairly successful. They had a pretty big ranch. My dad's dad always wanted to be a rancher. So there was kind of an interesting juxtaposition there. He was a very good welder, but he didn't take to authority. So he would get these really good welding jobs, and then he would get fed up and impatient and go quit and go find a job as a ranch hand somewhere. So they were often very kind of destitute. There were seven kids. So they both ended up becoming teachers. We kind of moved around a lot because my dad got various teaching jobs.
And that's what your book, Be a Man, Raised in the Shadow of Cowboys, begins with, the moving around and your dad being a teacher and then following his dream of being a ranch hand. And that created some tension in your parents'
relationship.
You want to talk about that?
When I was around 10, my dad somehow heard about this job managing a ranch between Sheridan, Wyoming and Billings. It was a ranch that was owned by Peter Kiewit, who was a pretty big construction magnate, and he owned this ranch as a hobby, tax shelter probably. So he wasn't really a solid presence there. But anyway, my dad somehow ended up getting this job. I'm still not sure, and I wish I'd asked him before he died how he got hired for that job. But he interviewed for the job, accepted the job, and quit his teaching job. All without telling my mother, because he knew she would be furious. So yeah, it was a bad situation from the start, and we were there for 2 years, and it essentially just got worse from there.
One of the things I noticed in reading Be a Man, I'm kind of glad I read Be a Man before I read In Open Spaces and Cold Country. Because I could see how you use your family's history and your own history in writing those books. And certainly Cold Country, the family dynamic there. One of the things I love about your writing, Russell, is you are fearless in just getting to the core truth of whatever the situation is, whether it's pretty or not. Talk to us about how you came to be able to do that.
As you know, I quit drinking when I was pretty young. I was 25. So I became very involved in the recovery process and did a ton of therapy. And I guess just from that experience, I learned the value of not avoiding hard topics. And I learned the value of talking about them openly with people that I trust. And one of the main reasons I wrote this book was because I wanted to let other men especially, but women too, know that we all have times in our life where we feel very much alone and afraid. And not sure where to turn. And it was really, really hard for me to reach out for help. And even when I did, I felt like I had to learn a whole new language. I didn't know how to talk about anything. The only emotion that we were allowed in my home was anger. So I had to learn to talk about all the other stuff. The fact that Montana has such a high suicide rate, I don't think that's an accident. I think it's all related to this inability and lack of role models when it comes to men especially, but women too, definitely, when it comes to just talking about what's going on in your life. It's a scary thing.
I was going to bring up the alcoholism later, but since we're here, I wonder if you would read these two paragraphs.
Okay.
Some of the most profound writing I've read on alcoholism.
Thank you. Just a few weeks before I admitted I had a problem, I went to a movie by myself one night, half drunk. There was a long line, and I struck up a conversation with a couple standing behind me. At first, the conversation was comfortable, easy. We chatted about current events and the weather, and they were friendly. But my desire to make any connection with other people had taken on an air of desperation that was palpable. I couldn't stop talking, and this poor couple started to get a panicked look on their faces. I suddenly felt small, so insignificant. I was scaring these people, and nothing I did or said could change that. The harder I tried, the worse it got. It made me incredibly sad. One of the most common misconceptions about alcoholism is that the standard of measure for someone with a drinking problem is quantity. But as any alcoholic will tell you, it's not the amount you drink. The thing that finally brings most of us to our knees is that the alcohol stops working. It's standing in line at a movie theater with a belly full of booze, remembering what it feels like to charm a table of beautiful women, trying to recapture that feeling with such a desperate energy that you scare everyone around you and yourself. It is feeling so completely separated from humanity that no amount of whiskey will bring you back. It is knowing without any doubt that the one friend you thought you could count on, alcohol, has become a blatant liar, and that the lies are becoming more elaborate and damaging by the day. Alcohol tells you that he's the only one you can trust. Alcohol tells you that he's the only one who knows what's good for you, and that everyone who gives you advice that contradicts his is against you, that they don't understand. Alcohol tells you that she is a much better lover than any woman could possibly be, that she will listen, that she will take care of you. The most frightening thing about it is that alcohol makes these arguments completely convincing.
You speculate about this, but the frequent moves that your family made may have been because of your father's alcoholism. It wasn't clear to me how aware you were as a child about that.
We were completely blindsided, actually, when my dad announced that he was going to get help, because we grew up in a culture where every guy drank. My dad had a bottle in the garage, and we all knew it. He had a bottle under the front seat of the car, and we all knew it. It was just kind of standard in those days. So when my father, he went to a conference in Minneapolis for parents who were worried about their kids' drug use. He went because of my brother. And while he was there, the counselor confronted him about his own drinking. And for whatever reason, my dad was ready to hear that, and he agreed to check into a treatment center. But when he called to tell my mom, she didn't have a clue that he was an alcoholic. Looking back, it's kind of ridiculous, because not only because of the bottles, but he would also frequently just not come home, not all night, but he wouldn't call. So my mom would be worried sick, and he'd finally show up hours later, drunk, and pretty standard alcoholic behavior, but we just didn't have a clue about the disease. We didn't know that those were pretty strong signs.
That was in the 70s, probably?
Yeah, he checked into treatment around 80, I think.
Yeah, things were, as a culture, our awareness, not just in the U.S., for example, in France as well, it was normal.
Yeah.
To have a bottle of wine at lunch in France and go back to work afterwards. I wouldn't say that was normal in the United States, but you hear about the three martini lunch for businessmen. So part of not being aware was just the culture didn't have the information.
Right.
And now I'm reading reports that this upcoming generation is, why drink?
Yeah.
What's the deal?
Yeah, I think it has changed a lot in that respect, for sure.
Let's get back to Be a Man, Raised in the Shadow of Cowboys. First of all, you address the question, what the hell is a cowboy? And you posited versus a rancher. Would you share with us your thoughts?
Well, yeah. So I was thinking about that, and I realized that a lot of people just assume there's a bunch of cowboys roaming around Montana, but the era of the actual cowboy was actually really short. So today, I think there's tons of ranchers around, and most of them don't even dress like cowboys anymore. You know, they wear lace-up boots and ball caps, and, you know, they don't ride horses. They use four-wheelers. So those are real ranchers. Then there's the rodeo cowboy, and they're their own breed.
And your dad was a rodeo cowboy.
Right. My dad was a rodeo cowboy and then ended up becoming a rodeo clown, And then there's the posers. And we see a lot of those in Montana, especially guys running for office who pose on a horse with a big hat. And I always think that's kind of hilarious because anybody in Montana knows what a phony persona that is. But they still cling to this notion that being a guy who takes charge and gets things done looks like a cowboy, you know. It's kind of been ingrained in our culture, even nationally, I think, right?
But then you go on to talk about, to the extent that there are cowboys, they're of a certain type. And I thought your description of the realities of that was valuable to know, especially in the context of guys running for office.
You must be referring to the ranch hands.
Yes.
Most of the ranch hands that worked on my grandparents' ranch were loners, were guys that would disappear for a couple weeks and come back all beaten up. And they obviously experienced a lot of disappointment in their lives. So they were just working whatever job they could find. And they were usually really good workers when they were there, but they didn't tend to be reliable. And the ones that were, they would stick around. But even those guys usually would go on a bender now and then. I think it was a very lonely existence.
Among the jobs that your dad had, he was a teacher, and he taught at the school that you went to from kindergarten to third grade. Now, I know of kids whose parents are teachers in the same school. What was that like for you?
Well, for the most part, it was pretty good because my dad was really popular with the kids. But there were also funny moments. Like one time I got in trouble. I must have been on the playground, and there was this real mean third grade teacher named Miss Wastowski, and she must have been on playground duty because she marched me up to my dad's classroom in the middle of class and told him what I'd done and then just left me there. And of course, my dad was embarrassed and probably angry at her. I mean, it was so inappropriate, but stuff like that used to happen too. But for the most part, I was kind of proud to be in the same school with my dad.
What I've heard before is that it makes it awkward with the other kids.
Right. That was never really an issue with him.
In one of your books, I guess it was Cold Country, when the family in the novel has moved to the Paradise Valley to ranch, a boutique ranch by a magnate from the building trades, that father had taught at the Hawthorne School in Bozeman. Now, that wasn't the school.
Right. The novel's based on our time at the ranch in Ranchester. But I moved it to Paradise Valley mainly because I didn't want to make anyone... I mean, a lot of these characters are based on real people, and I just wanted not to offend any of those people. And I never have heard anything from any of them, so I don't think I did, but who knows? But yeah, so I moved it to Paradise Valley.
Open Spaces is set at the Arbuckle family ranch, and you have Arbuckles in your family.
Yeah.
And you would work in the summer times there. And there's one incident riding the Cornemann calf.
Oh.
Would you relate that? Yeah. And you write that so much of your childhood in Montana can be summed up in this story. So share that with
our
listeners.
Yeah, so I think I was probably about 8. And my grandparents had these neighbors named the Cornemans. And they had a kid my age who I really liked. He and I were buddies, Kelly Korneman. So they took me over there one day to visit Kelly, and he asked me if I'd ever ridden a calf, and I lied. Said, of course I have, you know.
Now, at this point in your life, you'd been more or less an urban kid, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, we hadn't lived on a ranch at all by that time. We went out to the barn, and he had a calf all ready to go in the chute, and he got me all set up with spurs and chaps and the whole deal. Put me on the calf and opened the chute, and the calf bolted out of the chute, and I held on for a little while, but then the calf stopped dead, and I just went flying over its head and landed flat on my stomach. So I was completely out of wind and gasping for air, and Kelly was horrified, you know, so he's crouched over me. He's bawling. He was so scared. The next thing I knew, he was pulling my boots off, and I didn't really understand why he was doing that. But right about that time, his dad showed up and rescued me or whatever. But yeah, his dad always told that story later about how Kelly wasn't going to let his friend die with his boots on. So yeah, it was a legendary story in our family. And the thing that resonated about that story and so many other stories from the ranch was that it was just one more example where I felt like, okay, I'm never going to get this thing right. It made me feel like I wasn't cut out to be a Montana kid in some way. You know, I never was a hunter. I never was a fisherman. So all those things sort of start to build up over time where you feel like an outsider.
Nonetheless, it seems very clear from your writing that the time you spent on your grandparents' ranch was really formative. I would love it if you would share about your Uncle Lee. He certainly was a crucial figure in your life.
Lee was my mentor. Like I said, my mom's father died when she was 2. So her mother married Frank Arbuckle when mom was 6. And Frank and Mary Lee, my grandmother, had another son, and that was Lee. So he was my mom's half-brother. And they were very, very close. My mother used to play school with him before he was old enough to go to school, and they just developed a real strong bond. So he became a very interesting guy. He went into the Peace Corps when he was right out of college. And this was right when they were starting out, so he was kind of a trailblazer in that way. He went to Columbia the first time, and then when the Vietnam War broke out, he went before the draft board in Carter County. And I always think this story is kind of remarkable because Carter County is a fairly conservative county. And he told the draft board that he wasn't a conscientious objector, but that he didn't agree with the Vietnam War. And he would like to be able to do something else to serve the country. And they agreed to let him see if he could find anything. So he contacted one of his old Peace Corps buddies, and the guy found him a job as a director in Bolivia. So he moved down there, and that's where he met his wife, Maggie, who now owns the ranch, actually. They got married and ended up moving to the ranch. And they were planning to build a life there, but he developed MS when he was 32. So he was not able to fulfill that dream that he had. But, you know, he just went on to do a lot of amazing things. He worked for USAID for a long time, which makes all the recent news very sad to me because I know he loved that job. He was a remarkable guy.
Of all the many stories in here that you shared involving your Uncle Lee, would you choose one to share with our listeners?
I worked on the ranch for a summer when I was 16, and one day they were going to go visit some friends nearby, and Lee knew I liked to golf, so he suggested that I bring my golf clubs. He would let me use the car to go play golf at this local golf course. So they went into the house, and I drove off to go to this golf course, and I was feeling very pleased with myself. I don't think I even had my driver's license yet. So I'm barreling along this gravel road, and I was going way too fast, and the car went out of control, and I did a whole 360 and ended up in the ditch looking straight up at the sky. And I was, of course, scared to death. And it just so happened that this rancher came along who had a winch, and he was able to pull me out, and there was no damage to the car. I was just really, really lucky, but I was so shook that I didn't go play golf. I drove back to the other place and I was terrified. I mean, I just knew Lee was going to be so angry at me. And when I walked in, it was probably apparent on my face that something had happened because I was probably white as a ghost. And, you know, I told him what happened and he jumped up and thought he was coming after me. But instead, he came over and like he grabbed me and he says, "Are you okay?" And he was just so worried about me. And it was kind of a atypical reaction from an adult at the time. And it was just one example of so many where he responded to something like that very differently than a lot of the parents that were part of my childhood. You know, a lot of the adults in our family, there was just a lot of don't show emotion. We used to get spanked for crying. It was that kind of household. So yeah, he was unique.
We're going to skip over major portions of your book, going to college, getting a music degree, music education, right? And that's when your alcoholism really seems to take off.
Yeah.
You get married. And do you share what you want to share about that part of your life?
Yeah, so I was newly sober. I met a woman who was also in the program, and we fell in love. It was one of those relationships that everyone around us was really worried about, and for very good reason. You know, it was pretty tumultuous from the beginning.
And how old were you?
I was 24, 25 when we met, and she was 19, so she was very young. There weren't a lot of people that even had the courage to like suggest that we should wait or anything. We got married, I think, within a year of when we met. It was an abusive relationship. I was completely incapable of dealing with my anger at the time. I had a few relapses while we were married, so there was still drinking involved. I was just bad. But we stuck it out for 3 years, and there's a scene in the book where the last time I hit her, we had a son by then, and he was probably 6 months old. He was lying on the floor across the room, and he let out this piercing scream, like the minute my hand touched her face. And that just really broke me, and it was the catalyst for me finally getting the real help I needed for my abusive behavior. And so, yeah, I went into therapy and I've done a ton of therapy, thankfully. I think it's an issue that is so prevalent in the West, probably everywhere, but it always bugs me that public figures, they'll have them do a few months of anger management training or something. And I think it's just so much harder than that to get a handle on. It took me years of therapy to finally unwrap where all that anger came from and how to deal with it. So I think it's a serious issue that needs to get more attention.
Well, since it is such a prevalent issue in not just our culture, and not singular to men, but particular to men, what can you say about the roots of the anger that so often goes into violence, whether it's striking physically or rape? I think rape is in that category as well.
Right.
And not necessarily only men to women either. I think we don't talk about men to men rape, but it happens.
Definitely, yeah. I can really only speak for myself, but it's probably applies to a lot of men. I had never learned to deal with tiny, what seemed like insignificant emotional experiences. So if I got irritated with something, I would just try to brush it off and say, you know, just forget it. It'll go away. And they just never did. I was one of these guys who would replay things in my head and just get more and more angry the more time went on. Plus, I had a lot of deep-seated resentments from years before that I'd never addressed. You know, it's one of the things about the recovery program that became very valuable to me was addressing all those old resentments that fuel, because it always felt like my anger was so out of proportion to what was happening in front of me. So I know now that the reason for that was because I was reacting to years worth of frustration and disappointment and all the things that we all deal with on a daily basis. I just had never dealt with that stuff. So I had to do a lot of work resolving all those resentments and then just learning how to express myself about things that small things that were happening right now, being able to say that hurt my feelings. I always felt like that was a weak thing to even admit, or I'm afraid, things like that. I always explain it as basically learning a whole new language.
I have heard of the concept of a dry drunk. And my understanding of that is even when someone has stopped drinking and stopped for many years, some of the same disinhibitive behaviors can manifest. Have you heard that?
And oh, yeah.
So do you think that there's any truth to it?
Yeah, I've always kind of had a hard time with that term, but I do know, and I've experienced it myself, and I've seen it in other people, that sobriety is hard. And if you let up on all the things that are necessary to sustain it, you can go through periods where you're acting pretty much like you did when you were drinking. Mm-hmm. And that's how they describe it. It's basically an emotional relapse. So you're kind of resorting to old behaviors that you exhibited when you were drinking. And usually it's just a matter of figuring out what's bothering you. It's the same old thing of trying to identify what's happening in my life and being able to talk to somebody about it. Making connections with other people, to me, is the key to sustaining any kind of sober life. If you lose that connection with other people, you can quickly become an isolationist again and just fall back into those same patterns.
Well, that circles back to the rugged individual.
Yeah.
You just got to do it on your own. That's a significant sickness, I think, in our culture.
Yes.
And that's another way, Russell, in which your memoir, Be a Man Raised in the Shadow of Cowboys, is so useful for us in this moment that we're finding ourselves. Mm. And what you just said really amplifies that. Mm. While we're on the subject of violence, you do address Montana's legacy of violence.
Yeah.
And particularly for people who are new to Montana, they may not be aware of the history of vigilantism.
Mm-hmm.
And I first lived in Helena, and I was flabbergasted when the city shuts down, the schools all let out for the Vigilante Day. My understanding of vigilante was lynching black people.
The truth is not too far from that, actually, and it's scary how it's been brushed over or absolutely celebrated.
Yeah.
I mean, the Highway Patrol has 3777 on their badges, which is the code for the vigilantes. So what happened was, and most people know the first part of the story, which was that Henry Plummer and his deputies, he was elected sheriff of Bannock, and there was a lot of people that were getting robbed going from Bannock to Virginia City. During the gold rush, there was a huge gold rush in Bannock. So Plummer and his deputies, everyone thought, oh, when they elected this guy sheriff, he was going to finally take care of this problem. But he never did, and they finally realized he was part of the problem. So they strung those guys up, and that was all well and good because they didn't really have any other options at the time. The judge who was appointed to cover that territory was never sworn in, so he wouldn't step in. He wouldn't do anything. That was how it started, and then it quickly escalated. In fact, on the very same night that Henry Plummer was hung, the same crowd, hours later, probably after having a lot of celebratory beverages, they went to the house of this poor Mexican guy who had never broken the law. I think he'd been charged with breaking a window with his gun one time, but they just went to this guy's house and murdered him. So that sort of set the tone from that point forward. They wrote out a code of behavior, but they broke it all the time. Supposedly, they were only going to string up murderers and horse thieves, but they just completely crossed that line over and over and over again. It's a typical story of power that goes out of control. They became so powerful that a couple of the lawyers in Bannock actually confronted them about it, and they ran them out of town. One of those guys actually won a lawsuit later. So a story that's been completely retold to make these guys heroes. And they were at first, but eventually it became a problem and people just were too scared to do anything about it.
I'm so glad that you extended that to include the murder of Frank Little
yeah.
in Butte, the
right.
IWW organizer.
Yeah. That was horrible. Completely blatant lynching. They dragged him behind a car, then hung him. And all he had done was he came to try to help the union. But there was a huge fire in one of the mines in Butte that killed a bunch of guys. And the union wanted to use that incident to try to get more safety standards and better working conditions for the workers. And the company completely dug their heels in and wouldn't budge. So Frank Little came to help. And yeah, he got murdered.
Kind of out of the blue, you joined the Navy.
Yeah. It was right after my first wife left. I was emotionally shattered, and I lost my job just a week or two after she left. I was pretty desperate, and it was actually my Uncle Lee. I was telling him, I don't know what to do, and he says, well, you might think about the military. And I was completely the opposite of what you would typically think of as somebody who would join the military. But the more I thought about it, the more I thought, well, it's probably a good idea just to get my act together. So I did join the Navy for a 4-year stint, and I really hated every minute of it. But it did give me an opportunity to get my finances together. I put together enough of a portfolio to apply to graduate school. And I actually got to start graduate school just a couple weeks after I was discharged. So that worked out pretty well, actually.
And the rest is history.
Yeah.
Right. And so what years were those?
I joined in 86.
So it was the Reagan administration.
Yeah. One of the reasons I felt pretty comfortable joining was because I just thought, well, there's no way there's going to be any kind of war or anything. But by the time I got out, the first Gulf War was just starting to heat up.
You missed the invasion of Grenada.
I did, yeah. But they told us right up to the last minute, we're not sure we're going to let you guys go, which was a little disconcerting. Mm-hmm.
So that really was when your writing career got going. And would you say it's a vocation? You do have a chapter titled Married to My Word.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've always kind of described it as a sickness because I wanted to be a musician before that. And
you were a musician.
I played in clubs and stuff, but I just didn't have that passion for it. But when I started writing, it was almost immediate that I became completely obsessed with it. So yeah, it was sort of a laser focus from that point forward. It's been a blessing and a curse. I think it's definitely impacted my social life. But I love what I do. So yeah, once I started, and grad school was a huge part of that. I went to Boston University and had a really great experience there. Especially, I did an internship at the Atlantic Monthly. And the fiction editor there, Michael Curtis, was an incredible encouragement to me. He actually read the first few chapters of In Open Spaces and offered to help me get it published. Which didn't happen, but just the fact that he thought it was that good was a huge boost to my confidence. So yeah, from that point forward, I was pretty much obsessed with and willing to do whatever it took. I mean, it took another 11 years for me to get that book published, but I was able to get there. So
for incipient writers here listening to this, you do a nice job of the slings and arrows of outrageous publishing.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Without being too bitter about it.
Right. Yeah, there was a
nice
time.
Balance there.
There was a time when I was more bitter.
I bet, yeah. Well, you're at the mercy. You're
at, totally
the mercy.
At the mercy.
You know, you pour your heart into, like you said, 11 years. We can't let this go. So
I think I know it's coming.
So, what do you think's coming?
Fortune cookie.
Yes. All right. Tell the story.
Well, it's just so surreal. After I sold my first book, the publisher that bought it was bought out by a bigger publisher. My editor got laid off. I was going through all kinds of delays, assigned another editor every 6 months. I was so frustrated. And in the middle of all that, I'm just trying to do whatever it takes to make a living. So I get a call from a friend of mine one day. He says, hey, this guy came into my office today and he asked me if I was interested in writing fortune cookies. And this guy wasn't a writer, so he immediately thought of me. And so he put me in touch with this guy who was named Stephen Yang. He was a Chinese guy who owned this company that produced fortunes for fortune cookies. And I didn't find out until much later that he was one of only two companies in the whole country that provided these fortunes. So we had an interview that was just hilarious because he was clearly just desperate and he didn't really care about anything except whether I was willing to do it. So I agreed to write 700 fortunes and got paid a pittance for it. It was very low paying.
At this point, you had your master's degree.
Yeah, exactly.
Writing.
Yeah, writing fortunes. And I think I got 75 cents per fortune by the end of it. I asked for a raise partway through.
You had him over a barrel.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, I turned him in and, you know, I expected that to be the end of the story. But 6 months later, I got this phone call from an reporter at the LA Times who said, I've been trying to track you down because I'm getting a lot of complaints about the fortunes people are getting in fortune cookies.
Why would people complain to the LA Times?
Right? Yeah. Isn't that funny? Yeah, so anyway, he wrote a story about me, and I thought it would be like a little small article in the back in the art pages or something, but it was on the front page of the LA Times.
And this guy, he didn't just like pick up the phone and call. Yeah. He had to go through this whole thing finding you.
Yeah, that was another story on its own. Yeah, it took him forever. So yeah, the story appeared, and then, I don't know, maybe 6 months later, sometime later, I got a call from a game show. They wanted me to be on To Tell the Truth, which was one of my favorite game shows when I was a kid. So I got to do that, which was just a blast. Paula Poundstone was the only one who guessed the right Russell Rowland. So it was just funny. And it's a story that won't die either, because last year I got a call from a documentary filmmaker in New York who's making a film about fortune cookies. And he flew me out to New York to interview me one day. So it's funny.
You write, and I'm quoting you, "What chaps my hide," end of the quote, "writers who write about Montana without actually knowing Montana." And that goes for both books and TV shows. And you bring up the show Yellowstone, and you'll get an earful from just about anybody.
Yeah.
Share some thoughts on that.
Well, the thing that's frustrating for me and a lot of my writer friends here is that we've been writing for years about what Montana is really like. And a lot of us have dug really deep into not only our history, but what's happening now to try to get to the real truth of what it's like here. And it just seems like every time we're starting to gain a little traction, like The Power of the Dog came out, and I was so pleased with that movie because it was based on a story, a book written by a guy who grew up here, and it was so authentic. It captured what it's like here so well. And then right after that, Yellowstone comes along, and I watched the first episode, and that was all I could take because it was so reminiscent of the stuff that I grew up with as a kid, where men always respond with violence, men always respond by gritting their teeth and mumbling threats toward each other, drinking, and the whole deal. It's just very frustrating to me that rather than try to tell the story of what it's really like here, we always go back to these old stereotypes. And people just eat it up. I mean, there's something about that mythological version of the West that people love. And I understand it. I mean, I loved it when I was a kid, too. But I also came to realize how much damage it did to me as a man growing up here, because I was never one of those guys. And I always felt like an outsider because I wasn't one of these tough, stoic guys who love to go out and do whatever in the outdoors. It just makes me angry.
But that brings us back then, the urban West. You talk in that chapter about the history of Montana, which we won't go into now, but basically the gist of it is that from the time it was a territory till pretty much the present, it was an extraction of wealth that left, or very few actually benefited.
Right.
From it. And that was when it was not as populated as it is now. We're seeing a tremendous influx of population into Montana now, and it is primarily an urban influx. Yeah. Would you share your thoughts and observations about that, Russell?
I think we're going to have to figure out a way to adjust to what Montana is becoming. That's pretty clear. But the one thing that hasn't changed is that a lot of the big money that is coming into the state is it's the same old story. Montana is so blessed with so many resources, and that's always been a huge attraction for corporate America. I completely understand that. I think it has to be an important part of our industrial makeup that we're going to have these jobs available for mining and whatever else there is out there that provides jobs and a way to make a living. Wyoming has somehow figured out a way to take advantage of the same kind of resources to become a very wealthy state. Montana's never figured that out. We've always ended up having these guys like William Clark make their millions and then go away and leave a mess behind. You know, we've got three huge Superfund sites here that were all the result of William Clark and his ilk not giving a damn about what happens after they leave. And it's just always a concern for me. The way that these people always manage to avoid regulation is frightening. I would just love to see more of a leadership for the state that recognizes that we have to address both sides of the issue. It can't all be about making money and providing jobs. Preserving the land has to be a part of the picture too, and taking care of the people that work for a living.
In addition to writing your novels and 56 Counties, you also write for the Daily Montanan. And this past legislative session, the Republican majority was in an uproar because of the nine who decided to go back to old style politics of coalition and compromise and the greater good over party. Share some of your thoughts on what you observed with that dynamic.
Well, I thought it was very brave of those legislators to put their constituents first. Most of them expressed that sentiment, that the reason they were breaking with party was because they heard too much from their constituents that changed their mind about how they needed to approach things. And it was fascinating that they were censured by the party, just like Mark Roscoe was when he decided he was no longer going to just go along the party line. I think it's the type of courage that is very much needed right now, not just in Montana, but nationwide, as far as just standing up to this whole notion that, I mean, I've never quite understood how people can work so hard to become a congressman and then just step in line and agree to not have a single thought of their own. It makes no sense to me. But I guess that's what corruption's all about.
And Citizens United certainly contributes to that dynamic.
Absolutely.
And the terror of being primaried. You wrote a very interesting piece in the Daily Montana asking the question, why are liberals so scary? What would you like to share with our listeners in your thinking of answering the question, why are liberals so scary?
Yeah, I was thinking about why that label has become so fashionable. It's kind of a common theme with Republican politics, as we all know, that they like to put labels on people and just repeat it over and over again so people become convinced that liberals or socialists or whatever are up to no good. And most of the people I know that are fellow liberals are all about trying to make the world a better place. So it's just always fascinating and almost amusing to me that they've found a way to make us so scary. Most of my friends that are into that whole approach to government are anything but scary. They're pretty peace-loving people, but we're also pretty angry right now, so that might be part of it.
Lawrence O'Donnell, on June 3rd, 2025, in his newscast, quoted Harvard professor turned U.S. Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan, the concept of semantic infiltration, which he defined as one side forces another side to use its language to describe something. O'Donnell gave us the example, Rupert's naming his media company Fox News, which O'Donnell said it is anything but.
Right.
It's not news, but that's the name of it. So you have, if you're referring to it, you have to say Fox News. Or the other example is the Big Beautiful Bill. Well, the Democrats have been calling it the Big Ugly Bill, but now with Elon Musk, we have the Disgusting Abomination Bill. I know I'm springing this on you, but do you have any thoughts on that as a wordsmith?
One of the problems that's very clear in today's political world is that the Republicans have become very good at messaging, and the Democrats have never, ever been able to master that. We spend way too much time explaining and trying to justify and apologizing, and it's become a rock fight. There just has to be a time where the Democrats are willing to fight dirty, and I think that it's really sad that it's come to that. But yeah, that kind of messaging seems to be very effective, and we've just never quite figured out how to do that.
The rescission of the funding for the Corporation of Public Broadcasting just was announced 2 days ago from when we're having this interview on June 6, 2025. And of course, your program, 56 Counties, is on Yellowstone Public Radio. I wonder if you have any thoughts you'd like to share.
It's scary. I'm also part of the Humanities Montana Speakers Bureau, which was cut. So I'm no longer able to do that. Of course, it's maddening because it's such a tiny, tiny percentage of the national budget. But it's also very clear that these organizations are being targeted because they offer opportunities for people to gather and talk about what's going on in their state. And there's shows on YPR and NPR and PBS that really make a concerted effort to bring the facts to the people. And right now, the people that are in charge don't want the facts out there. So it's really that simple, I think. They're doing exactly what Hitler did in the 30s to try to tamp down what Putin has become so good at, too. I mean, they're just following a basic playbook that has been around forever. And thankfully, I think America is pretty determined to not let that happen. So I hope it doesn't go much further. But yeah, it's pretty frightening to me.
How do you respond to someone who says, I don't want my tax dollars going to a radio station or a TV station that expresses viewpoints I don't agree with?
Well, a lot of us don't want our tax dollars going to a huge industrial complex either. A lot of us don't want our tax dollars going to a lot of things that are happening. The fact that people think that they have any kind of control over what their tax dollars go to is, I think it's naive and delusional to believe that just voicing that is going to make it go away.
So, Russell Rowland, you've done a lot of interviews in your life. You've actually conducted a lot of interviews in your life. Is there a question that you're never asked about your books in particular that you wish you were? And if so, let's answer it now.
That's a great question. Well, one of the things that came up when I was thinking about doing this interview with you, because I know you're such a thoughtful interviewer, was I started out as a fiction writer, and I tried to write nonfiction for years. And I could just never get the hang of it. I would try to write an essay, and I could never wrap up my thoughts in a way that made sense to me or that got the point across that I was trying to get to. I tried to write nonfiction stories. And I don't know what it was, but I think it's pretty interesting that once I wrote 56 Counties, which did really well and is still selling really well, my focus kind of shifted to nonfiction, and that was so unexpected to me. I mean, I think it's a good example of how we don't have a lot of control over the direction our career takes, and sometimes that can be a real blessing. I have come to really enjoy writing nonfiction. You mentioned the column I do for the Daily Montana, and I never thought I would be doing something like that. So that's been a real great added benefit to that. But yeah, I've enjoyed writing these nonfiction books so much, even though they're really, really hard. They're way harder than fiction. Fiction is, to me, way easier because you just make it up, you know.
You get paid to lie, as
exactly.
Some say.
Yes. So yeah, it's just interesting how our careers follow a path that we might not foresee.
Do you believe in the concept of the muse?
Totally. Yeah, absolutely. One of the most important ingredients of that is paying attention. Like if you're being nudged in a certain direction, you have to pay attention to that and follow it, or you're going to probably suffer.
I will just add that since we do have so many newcomers to our state, 56 Counties is a really good book to begin with. It's a huge state, let's face
yeah.
it. That's a good place to start with familiarizing oneself with Montana.
I appreciate that. I've been really trying to get motivated to put out an audio version of that.
In your own voice?
Yeah.
Good.
People would like to listen to it while they're driving around the state, but I haven't gotten around to it. Yeah. That was a fun book.
It's fun to read, too. Yeah. Very interesting. Russell, is there anything that we haven't touched on from Be a Man Raised in the Shadow of Cowboys that you want us to be sure to include?
I just want to put out the basic word that if anyone out there is feeling alone or scared and not sure where to turn for help, there are incredible resources. We've come a long way in Montana as far as there's several organizations now available to help people find help for mental health problems, and telehealth has become a huge resource. So I just would encourage people to get over the stigma of this being some kind of weakness, asking for help.
You begin your book with this epigraph, a quote from Desmond Tutu, and let's end our interview with that quote.
I like that idea, yes. True reconciliation exposes the awfulness, the abuse, the hurt, the truth. It could even sometimes make things worse. It is a risky undertaking, but in the end it is worthwhile, because in the end, only an honest confrontation with reality can bring real healing. Superficial reconciliation can bring only superficial healing. Yes, Desmond Tutu, a wise man.
Well, Russell Rowland, thank you so much for your work and for joining us today on Echo Tones. We very much appreciate
it. It's been my absolute pleasure. Thank you so much, Joy.
You have just heard a conversation with Russell Rowland about his latest book, a memoir titled Be a Man, Raised in the Shadow of Cowboys. An ecotone is a transition zone between two biomes. It's the place where communities meet and integrate. This program, Ecotones, explores the variety and diversity of the Greater Gallatin Valley community and beyond, offering the echoing tones as our communities influence and are influenced by each other, bridging limits and boundaries and celebrating diversity. Ecotones is a Beyond the Deep End production, hosted and produced by Joy LaClaire in Bozeman, Montana, for broadcast on KGVM Bozeman and archiving at kgvm.org, as well as forthright.media.